Good morning, everyone. Good mid-morning, everyone. Okay. Second case of the day is 09-1404 Para versus Neal. And Mr. Mondragon.
Mr. Mondragon, yes. Good morning, judges. Good morning, Mr. Scanlon, Ms. Agnew. My name again is Adolfo Mondragon. I am one of the attorneys for the plaintiff's appellants, the voters of the 25th Ward. May it please this court. The law is well settled that when a group of voters are handed ballots by election officials that unsuspected by all are invalid, state law may forbid counting the ballots, but the election itself becomes a flawed process. In this case, the undisputed facts demonstrate that the board's decision to allow Ambrosio Medrano to run for alderman and its decision to issue ballots indicating that Ambrosio Medrano was a legitimate candidate for alderman led directly to the Illinois Supreme Court's supervisory order instructing the board to quash the ballots cast by plaintiff's appellants. The board's retroactive invalidation of the votes cast by plaintiff's appellants violated due process because it changed the rules at the end of the game, leaving an entire group of voters without a voice in an election that was decided by a margin of 1.39%, thereby eviscerating any semblance of fair play and impugning the integrity of the entire election.
Now, tell me this. Do you have a standing problem for the portion of the case that alleges disenfranchisement of the people who wrote in aldermanic candidates in the 25th Ward? In other words, are any of your plaintiffs claiming that they wrote in a vote for Sherrard, but it was not counted?
Although none of the plaintiffs, the named plaintiffs, cast a vote for Roland Girard, the class, which hasn't been certified yet, includes any voter in the 25th Ward that cast a lawful vote and whose vote was not counted. So the category is broad enough to encompass the people who wrote in Roland Girard as a candidate for alderman.
Does anything in the record show that anyone actually cast a ballot for Girard? Do you have any affidavits from anyone who did or some indicia that they've actually...
We don't have affidavits from anyone, but we do have indicia. We have facts that have been admitted and a legal presumption that we're relying on. Specifically, the board admitted that 24 write-in votes were cast. The board also admitted that Roland Girard ran as a legitimate candidate. The legal presumption in this situation is that every ballot that is cast is valid, and unless that presumption is rebutted, that presumption stands. Furthermore, the record indicates that the board admitted that Roland Girard was registered to vote, that her fellow SWP member, Ernest Mailhot, was registered to vote in the 25th Ward, and that both of these individuals showed up on election day and voted. Now, someone who's a seasoned politician, political activist, like Ms. Girard, like Mr. Mailhot, it's beyond belief that they would go through all the trouble of becoming legitimate write-in candidates in an election, showing up on election day, and then not voting for themselves. So this adds credence to the legal presumption that every ballot cast, that is the 24 write-in ballots that were cast, are valid. Indeed, one doesn't need a legal education to understand that it is patently and fundamentally unfair for election officials to refuse to count votes lawfully cast on ballots that the election officials themselves prepared, issued, and sanctioned. In other words, there's something wrong, nay absurd, in depriving a lawful voter of the franchise merely because he or she reasonably relied on the expert pronouncements and decisions of the election officials. If you can't count on the official ballot, what can you count on?
Well, look, don't people who use early voting assume the risk that their candidate might die, might be convicted of a crime, might pull out of the race, or perhaps that some unseemly facts might be, you know, uncovered about the candidate just prior to the election? I mean, it seems to me that that's an inherent part of early voting, of which any you know, voter using common sense might be aware. Would you argue that if any or all of those scenarios occur, early votes ought to be given, or I should say early voters, ought to be given a second stab at the apple?
Well, although those things could be assumed to happen, I think it's clear in Griffin and in Holblock that the responsibility shouldn't be placed on the voter to somehow divine or foresee that these individuals are going to be knocked off the ballot. If anyone should bear the responsibility, it should be the election officials, who are, after all, experts. They're the ones who are have knowledge of the election law, and it's their doing that led to the situation. The violation occurred when they made the decision to allow Medrano to be on the ballot, when they ruled that a provision from the municipal code was unconstitutional and that he should be allowed to run, and decided to issue these ballots. Ultimately, their decision to disenfranchise these individuals starts and ends with the electoral board, because it's their decision that sets this whole process into action.
But it appears that the board doesn't have the option of postponing the election, as the Illinois statute would forbid holding an election at such unscheduled time, and the only facts in the record indicate that it would not have been possible for the board to remove Mr. Medrano's name in time for the election.
Well,
what other options did the board have?
Well, the board had the discretion to do something to prevent them. That's the tragedy of this case.
Do something.
Yes. For one thing, they could have postponed the election.
Well, we just
although the election code is silent on the matter, there is no case law that says that the board is prohibited from postponing an election. In fact, we have a situation that just occurred in March where the clerk of Champaign County postponed early voting for 10 days in order to get to reprint ballots that were defective. The same thing could have been done in this matter.
Postponed early voting. Which is by its definition early.
Yes, sir.
So they just made it less early. And I've got to ask you anyway, if someone dies, votes early and dies, does their vote count?
Their vote, yes, their vote should count. It was lawfully cast at the time of the election.
Okay.
But
that's not the answer to that. I just wondered if you did.
Yes.
Because I think it's certainly debatable.
Yes, and it doesn't also follow that they don't have discretion to postpone an election, because it would lead to the absurd result of holdover candidates. For example, if there was an act of God in early February or in late February, a blizzard, for example, or a man-made act like an electrical power outage that made it impossible for individuals to vote on that scheduled date, I don't think the board would say that these incumbents would now hold over and usurp power for another 4 years merely because the day came by and went. They couldn't hold another election on another day.
Well, suppose the board had decided to postpone the election a day in the 25th, just for a few days to print new ballots. I think we might be sitting here listening to the claims of citizens who arrived on election day to vote and found the polls were closed and were unable to take another day off of work or another few hours off of work to vote. In other words, why do you think we should take your word that your plan is a less intrusive invasion upon constitutional rights than the one that the Board of Elections came up with?
Because it's a clean slate. Everyone starts over on the same ground, playing on the same rules, as opposed to relying on the alternative and just saying, forget about it, we're going to do the ultimate penalty on these individuals and deprive them of a fundamental right. This way, everyone gets to start afresh, everyone gets to start anew, and everyone gets a voice in a very contested election.
But are there any Illinois election laws that you allege were violated here?
In terms of not counting the votes? No, what we allege is that the Constitution of the United States was violated.
I know. I know that.
And which is what separates this matter from something of a garden variety, because
but
this
no,
is...
And no Illinois election laws.
No Illinois election laws. In fact, the code itself is silent on the matter of postponing the election. But as I've said, just recently in March, downstate, the clerk of the Champaign County saw fit to postpone an election for 10 days until he got the ballots right. So there is precedence to this happening, even though the actual statute doesn't speak to it.
You would agree. Held on a regular day, right? The election was held on Election Day, right?
The election was held on Election Day, Your Honor. But individuals were not induced to vote on defective ballots, as happened in this case.
Would you agree that you have to show that there was willful conduct?
The standard is clear, Your Honor. It's willful conduct. And Griffin and Hoblock make it clear that willful conduct, the standard is meant when election officials hand out ballots that are turn out to be invalid and then refuse to count those ballots, which is exactly what happened in this case.
But how can we have a willful violation when it appears that the board was, first of all, following the directive of the Illinois Supreme Court, and second of all, really, it would seem, did its best to inform the citizenry, the electorate, that the votes for Mr. Medrano would not be counted.
Well, the case law is clear that the violation itself occurs not when the state overturns those ballots and orders the electoral board to invalidate those ballots, but it begins far earlier in the process. The catalyst of all this is the decision, the calculated, reasoned, legal decision to look at a provision in state law, declare it unconstitutional, say that this individual is allowed to vote, and then issue ballots indicating that the person, the felon, is a legitimate candidate. So the catalyst of all of this is the legal, calculated, reasoned decision to place an issue, to place the candidate on the ballot and to issue those ballots. It's the exact same thing that occurred in Griffin and in Hoblock. The board's after-the-fact decision to deprive plaintiff appellants of their right to vote also violated equal protection because the decision was not the least restrictive means of achieving a compelling state interest, as we've been talking about.
What is it you're saying, postponing the election is the least restrictive means?
It is one. It's a far less restrictive method than disenfranchising individuals. Postponing the election and starting anew would lead to an election where everybody's voice was heard. And so it is a least restrictive method than depriving someone of something as fundamental as the right to vote.
Were there other offices up for election on that same day?
There were many offices. The 25th Ward was not the sole contest in the city of Chicago in the Cook County area.
Postponement then only for that ward?
Only for that ward. It wouldn't be...
How many people you think would vote when... President or whoever else is president's
out on that subsequent vote. Well, in this particular, and I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, but in this particular case, we have to also remember that this was a runoff rules election, which the policy behind it already envisioned a second election down the line. So postponing this election wouldn't have been much trouble because on April 7th, guess what? We're scheduled to have another election. In fact, maybe a runoff from this very election. So it wouldn't have been much trouble to postpone this particular election.
Don't worry about the rebuttal time. I'll give you some more time and, of course, the same. But bottom line, let's look at the bottom line. Isn't it possible that the state's interest in keeping convicted felons out of office is compelling enough, even though its ability to effectuate that interest is imperfect?
Well, it may be a legitimate concern, and in some states, under some schemes, it may be a compelling interest. But it cannot be a compelling interest, or that is to say, an interest of the highest order, where the state condones an electoral system that has loopholes that allow these individuals, these convicted felons, from actually making it to the ballot when they're not challenged. In fact, in this very case, two individuals who were convicted felon made it on, while two individuals didn't. I don't see how that could be compelling. If it was compelling, we'd have a system that would allow these individuals, that would allow the board to do everything possible to keep these individuals from being on the ballot. But that's not the case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Scanlon.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, James Scanlon for the defendants. Your Honors, I would like to begin just by addressing some of the questions that were asked by you and Mr. Mondragon's responses to those. I think the first question from Judge Rovner was with regard to standing. And we have to keep in mind that the original complaint that was filed in this matter dealt only with the Medrano voters. When the district court dismissed that complaint, they filed an amended complaint, and they added a couple of paragraphs dealing with write-in votes allegedly cast for Roland Girard. None of the plaintiffs, by their admission in the pleadings, voted for Ms. Girard. They all claim, although there's no proof of it, they all claim that they voted for Mr. Medrano. So are they in a position to advance arguments on behalf of Ms. Girard? I question whether they have standing to do so. They certainly did not suffer an injury because of any votes cast or not cast for Ms. Girard. They were completely different issues altogether. Ms. Girard's situation was not one that was caused by the Illinois Supreme Court's decision, which was what drove the claims in regard to Mr. Medrano. Her situation is that she alleges, or I shouldn't say she alleges, because she's not here, but the PARA plaintiffs allege that there were 24 votes cast for Ms. Girard. There's no evidence to support that. None whatsoever.
Well, mostly I think they want the number in there to bring the total up to 50 point something percent.
1%.
I believe you may be right, Judge, because in the original complaint, you know, with regard to the Medrano votes, there were 178 votes. And even if you counted all those, Mr. Solis would still have had a majority of the votes cast and would have been the winner in the February 27th election. So the plaintiffs, I think, realized they needed a little bit more. And lo and behold, we found some allegations that there are 24 additional votes. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, I'm sorry. at least as the candidates who had voted earlier by absentee ballot, of whom, you know, there were only 90 for Mr. Medrano?
Correct.
Would it have been possible to have contacted those voters and offered them the opportunity to re-vote on the scheduled election day?
The short answer, Your Honor, is no. And we have to keep in mind that those 90 were a combination, actually, of absentee ballots, grace period voting. There were two ballots cast during grace period voting, and early voting. There were 67 votes cast during early voting. You know, contrary to public perception and the media, you can vote early, but you can't vote often. You can only vote once. And once you voted, there is nothing to connect that vote with the voter. That's intended to protect the secrecy of the ballot. So we would have no way of knowing which voters cast a vote for Mr.
Medrano. You would have to contact all of the early voters, all of the absentees that came in early, and all the grace period voters, and let them all re-vote?
No,
whether they voted for Medrano or not, right?
Well, that may be a hypothetical solution, but Illinois law does not allow you to vote a second time. It's clear. When you vote, when you cast your vote, especially in early voting, when you cast your vote, you cannot vote again. Now, with regard to absentee ballots, a voter could take that absentee ballot with him or her to the polling place on election day and hand that absentee ballot to the judges of election and cancel that absentee ballot, and they would be allowed to vote in person. That's the exception.
Apparently, an absentee ballot is a paper ballot of some kind that you mail in.
Yes, that is correct.
Early voting, you go to some place and vote on a machine, I guess.
Yes, early voting is conducted on touchscreen voting devices. But there is essentially no mechanism by which people would be allowed to recast the vote. It just cannot be done without violating the secrecy of the ballot. That certainly, I think, is a smokescreen.
What should we make of 10 ILCS 5/8-17? I know you probably know exactly what that says, but I'll read it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Which states that the death of any candidate prior to or on the date of the primary shall not affect the canvass of the ballots if the result of such canvass discloses that such candidate, if he had lived, would have been nominated. Such candidate shall be declared nominated. Does that indicate a policy in the state of Illinois to count all votes, even ones that cannot be effectuated? And I think that's sort of a corollary to my brother Mannion's question.
I believe, Judge, that it reflects a policy on the part of the state of Illinois to count votes that are cast for candidates who die. And, you know, it may be a sort of a subset of the American rule that was cited by the plaintiffs in their papers. But it's limited only to candidates who die. There is no similar exception for other types of candidates, for example, candidates who voluntarily withdraw from the race, or candidates who involuntarily withdraw because a court of jurisdiction disqualifies them and finds that they're ineligible to be a candidate, such as what occurred here with Mr. Pedrano.
No, in the case of the death, I think we're referring to being nominated, right?
That's correct. And it applies to a primary.
Already an opportunity to go through a process to substitute.
That's correct. And it only applies to primary, in which case the person is nominated. If the person is dead, it creates a vacancy on nomination, which then allows the political party committees to appoint someone to fill the vacancy on nomination so that they will have a candidate of their party at the general election. So it's very limited in scope. And it doesn't cover the situation we have here. There's nothing in Illinois law which would compel that the votes counted for a candidate who is disqualified by a court of competent jurisdiction be counted. In this case, the Illinois Supreme Court stepped up and said expressly and clearly that those votes could not be counted. It said the Electoral Board is required to disregard those votes in determining the winner of this election.
Is it your view that Illinois has a system that allows for truly effective review of write-in votes?
Well, Your Honor, as we try to explain in the brief, it is the duty of the judges of election in the precincts to examine each write-in vote that's cast and to make a determination whether or not that is a valid write-in vote. And there are a number of criteria that they look at in making that determination. But it's their judgment. And at the end of the day, they're required to certify the results of that election. And if there are any valid write-in votes, they're required to list those write-in candidates and the number of valid write-in votes that he or she received. That's the certification of election results that's created and executed by the judges of election. Those certifications are then sent to the Board of Elections, and the Board canvasses the results of the election. And essentially, the board's role is very limited. It's very ministerial. And case law in Illinois explains that it's very limited. Essentially, we get the calculators out and we add up the totals that are presented by the judges of election. And it's based on those results from the judges of election that the board declares. Now, there was a Freedom of Information request that was filed with the board on March 2nd, which was prior to the official proclamation of the results of the election. So, you know, the board was still in the process of counting votes. We had additional provisional votes to count. We had additional absentee ballots that were coming in through the mail. So the process has not been completed, but we received the request. We complied with it. We turned over a record that indicated that there were 24 write-in votes. That doesn't mean they're valid. Far from it. All it means is a machine caught a mark where a person would make a fill in the space, fill in the error for a write-in vote. A machine caught a mark. That's all it means. Doesn't mean it's a valid write-in vote. The board takes the official certification results from the judges of election and then declares the winners of the election. And in this case, based on the certifications that were executed by the judges of election, there were no valid write-in votes for any candidate in the 25th Ward. Now, the plaintiffs would like... I'm sorry.
Is that an unusual situation?
Unusual? I can't say that it's unusual because, you know, it could be an invalid vote for any number of reasons. Any number of reasons.
But, I mean, none? Not one?
No, I think that that's fairly typical.
Wow.
There are not that many write-in candidates, and there are not that many write-in votes. It's unusual.
Well,
to have
precise, I don't know about write-in votes in Illinois, but I assume there's a requirement. You got to make it legible. You got to do something with the name, and you got to fill in blank. Is there a way to do it?
Yes, and on the ballot.
Write them in when you can't.
On the ballot, we're talking about a paper optical scan ballot. On that ballot, below the names of all the candidates whose names would be printed on the ballot, there is a line, and next to that line there is a space in which the voter can connect the arrow to indicate they want to cast a write-in vote. They also have to write in the name of the candidate.
Is it required that the write-in candidates declare in advance that they're
yes.
subject to being written in?
Yes, because Illinois law only allows election officials to count absentee ballots for candidates who file this declaration of intent. And we admitted in this case there was a declaration of intent.
It was just the one, right, Gerard?
That's correct.
So all the people that voted for Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and me, those didn't count?
No, Judge. They do not count. And that basically is your verdict case, where the state of Hawaii was not required to provide for write-in votes, and they were sued because certain people in the community felt they had a right to cast a vote for Donald Duck. And the Illinois Supreme Court said, no, that's not the case. That's not what the Constitution requires. So we could have had the ever-popular Donald Duck receiving write-in votes in that race. We don't know. We don't know. And the plaintiffs do not know. They're making assumptions. They're drawing inferences, first of all, based on evidence that's not admissible. I mean, that's a serious problem with this case. Much of what the plaintiffs have tried to use to prove their facts in support of the motion for summary judgment is based on newspaper articles that are not admissible. Nonetheless, they continue to recite, the fact that Ms. Gerard is a member of the Socialist Party, Mr. Marlowe is a member of the Socialist Party. This is what we're to assume from all the newspaper accounts from the socialist newspaper, and that we also are being asked, and the court is being asked, to infer that there are at least 22 other members, 22 other Socialist Party members in that ward who came out to vote for Ms. Girard. And there's absolutely no evidence of that. None whatsoever. With regard, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
And we'll add time to Mr. Gons.
Your Honor, I was going to say, Judge Tinder raised the question about willful conduct. The test in this circuit, and in most of the circuits in the country, is that in order to sustain a 1983 claim, you have to show willful conduct that undermines the organic processes by which candidates are elected. And this court in the Kosciuszczyk versus Brewer case pointed out that when we say willful, what we mean is an intent to undermine the electoral process or an intent to impair someone's vote. Now, they didn't quite come out and say what intent means, but I think it's clear from that case, also from Bodine versus Elkhart County and Hennings versus Grafton. But by using the word intent, what they mean is there is some purpose, there is some motive, some malevolent motive and purpose involved in the conduct. I think what the plaintiffs want this court to do now is to accept a different test, a different standard of what constitutes willful conduct. Their argument is if you did it, it's a violation of the Constitution, arises to a violation of the Constitution, if you did it. Because if you did it, you meant to do it. You intended to do it. And I don't think that's what this circuit or most of the circuits in this country require in terms of a Section 1983 claim. They are requiring that there be some showing of fraud, some malevolent intent to undermine the rights of voters. That's not present in this case. And I think that's even admitted by the plaintiffs in page 5 of their reply brief. He indicated there was no lack of a ulterior and nefarious motive. And they're saying notwithstanding that lack, there's still a violation of the Constitution. I don't think that's the law. Thank you,
Mr. Scanlon.
We would ask that the court affirm the judgment of this trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time? Well, we're going to add Mr. Scanlon's time, so how much time? Thank you. We only speak in...
Thank you, Judge. I'll try to address as many of these points as I can. First, I'd like to note that the outcome of the election is a mere consideration for the remedy of the violation, not the violation itself. Griffin clearly states that the violation occurs when the board intentionally issues the ballots that are later found to be invalid and then refuses to tally those ballots. The outcome of the election is only a consideration in determining whether or not a new election is required. And in Griffin, the court clearly rejected an outcome determinative test, and it stated that under conditions such as the ones found here, where the right to vote is at stake and the election is close, and here the election, the margin of victory was 1.39%, that comity necessitates a new election. A new election, indeed, is already envisioned in a runoff rule election. Two, Mr. Scanlon talks about a cumulative vote of the law doesn't allow people to vote more than once. That's not what we're asking for in this case, and we're saying that a new election would have been a distinct vote starting anew, tabula rasa, clean slate, not a cumulative vote of allowing individuals who voted early to come back and get another vote and thus voting twice for an individual. Third, disenfranchising individuals, such as in this case, undermines the policy of early voting. For one thing, it encourages straw candidates, to go into the early voting process, lock in people's votes, and then have those individuals just voluntarily withdraw from the election or have someone knock them out through the objection process. And if we don't have a pragmatic remedy, such as the general rule of American elections or postponement of the election, this is what you're going to have all the time. You're going to have people whose votes are locked in and then taken out of the pie, and particularly in runoff elections, where a vote for a candidate not only helps you elect that candidate, but if your candidate does not win, it, in the aggregate, it also is a vote against the incumbent and forces him into a runoff. And the other point about the standard willful conduct, no one debates that that's the bright line rule. But there are cases that talk about what a garden variety is that lies on this side of the spectrum and when the standard is met. And the facts in this case clearly are in point with Griffin and Hoblock that fall on this side of the standard. They are not garden variety. They are not machine error. They are not honest human mistakes, somebody misplacing an X, or a judge forgetting to sign a signature on a ballot. This is clearly an intentional, calculated decision by the board to interpret a state law and then decide, based on their interpretation, to issue ballots that later on turn out to be invalid. So, Your Honor, it's not a garden variety case. It's a case that clearly meets the standard, which no one here objects to. If there are any further questions, I rest my case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Montrecon.